cube. Waterhouse and a few dozen strangers are standing and sitting in an extraordinarily long, narrow room that rocks from side to side. The room is lined with windows, but no light comes into them, only sound. A great deal of rumbling, rattling, and screeching. Everyone is pensive and silent, as if they were sitting in church, waiting for the service to kick off. Waterhouse is standing up, gripping a ceiling-mounted protuberance that keeps him from being rocked right onto his can. For the last couple of minutes, he has been staring at a nearby poster providing instructions on how to put on a gas mask. Waterhouse, like everyone else, is carrying one such device with him in a small dun canvas shoulder bag. Waterhouse's looks different from everyone else's because it is American and military. It has drawn a stare or two from the others. On the poster is a lovely and stylish woman with white skin and auburn hair, which appears to have been chemically melted and reset into its current shape at a quality salon. She stands upright, her spine like a flagpole, chin in the air, elbows bent, hands ritualistically posed, fingers splayed, thumbs sticking straight up in the air just in front of her face. A sinister lump dangles between her hands, held in a cat's cradle of khaki strapping. Her upthrust thumbs are the linchpins of this tidy web. Waterhouse has been in London for a couple of days now, and so he knows the next part of the story. He would know this pose anywhere. This woman is poised for the chin thrust. If gas ever falls on the Capitol, the gas rattles will sound, and the tops of the massive mailboxes, which have all been treated with special paint, will turn black. 20 million thumbs will point into the greenish poison sky. 10 million gas masks will dangle from them. 10 million chins will thrust. He can just imagine the crisp, luscious sound of this woman's soft, white skin forcing itself into the confining black rubber. Once the chin thrust is complete, all is well. You have to get the straps neatly arranged atop your auburn permanent and get indoors, but the worst danger is past. The British gas masks have a squat round fitting on the front to allow exhalation, which looks exactly like the snout of a pig, and no woman would be caught dead in such a thing if the models in the gas mask posters were not such paragons of high caste beauty. Something catches his eye out in the darkness beyond the window. The train has reached one of those parts of the underground where dim gun-barrel-colored light sifts down, betraying the Stygian secrets of the tube. Everyone in the car blinks, glances, and draws breath. The world has rematerialized around them for a moment. Fragments of wall, encrusted trusses, bundles of cable hang in space out there, revolving slowly like astronomical bodies as the train works its way past. The cables catch Waterhouse's eye, neatly bracketed to the stone walls in parallel courses. They are like the creepers of some plutonic ivy that spreads through the darkness of the tube when the maintenance men aren't paying attention, seeking a place to break out and up into the light. When you walk along the street, up there in the overground, you see the first tendrils making their way up the ancient walls of the buildings. Neoprene jacketed vines that grow in straight lines up sheer stone and masonry and inject themselves through holes in window frames, homing in particularly on offices. Sometimes they are sheathed in metal tubes. Sometimes the owners have painted them over. But all of them share a common root system that flourishes in the unused channels and crevices of the underground, converging on giant switching stations and deep bomb-proof vaults. The train invades a cathedral of dingy yellow light and groans to a stop, hugging the aisle. Lurid icons of national paranoia glow in the niches and grottos. An angelic, chin-thrusting woman anchors one end of the moral continuum. At the opposite, we have a succubus in a tight skirt, sprawled on a davenport in the midst of a party, smirking through her false eyelashes as she eavesdrops on the naive young serviceman gabbing away behind her. Signs on the wall identify this as Euston, in a tasteful sans-serif that screams official credibility. Waterhouse and most of the other people get off the train. After 15 minutes or so of ricocheting around the station's precincts, asking directions and puzzling out timetables, Waterhouse finds himself sitting aboard an intercity train bound for Birmingham. Along the way, it is promised, it will stop at a place called Bletchley. Part of the reason for the confusion is that there is another train about to leave from an adjacent siding, which goes straight to Bletchley, its final destination, with no stops in between. Everyone on that train, it seems, is a female in a quasi-military uniform. The RAF men with the Sten guns, standing watch by each door of that train, checking papers and passes, will not let him aboard. Waterhouse looks through the yellowing influence of the windows at the Bletchley girls in the train, facing each other in clashes of four and five, getting their knitting out of their bags, turning balls of Scottish wool into balaclavas and mittens for convoy crews in the North Atlantic, writing letters to their brothers in the service and their mums and dads at home. The RAF gunmen remain by the doors until all of them are closed and the train has begun to move out of the station. As it builds speed, the rows and rows of girls, knitting and writing and chatting, blur together into something that probably looks a good deal like what sailors and soldiers the world over are commonly seeing in their dreams. Waterhouse will never be one of those soldiers out on the front line, out in contact with the enemy. He has tasted the apple of forbidden knowledge. He is forbidden to go anywhere in the world where he might be captured by the enemy. The train climbs up out of the night and into a red brick arroyo, headed northwards out of the city. It is about 3 in the afternoon. That special BP train must have been carrying swing shift gals. Waterhouse has the feeling he will not be working anything like a regular shift. His duffel bag, which was packed for him, is pregnant with sartorial possibilities. Thick oiled wool sweaters, tropical weight Navy and Army uniforms, black ski mask, condoms. The train slowly pulls free of the city and passes into a territory patched with small residential towns. Waterhouse feels heavy in his seat and suspects a slight uphill tendency. They pass through a cleft that has been made across a low range of hills like a kerf in the top of a log and enter into a lovely territory of subtly swelling emerald green fields strewn randomly with small white capsules that he takes to be sheep. Of course, their distribution is probably not random at all. It probably reflects local variations in soil chemistry, producing grass that the sheep find more or less desirable. From aerial reconnaissance, the Germans could draw up a map of British soil chemistry based upon analysis of sheep distribution. The fields are enclosed by old hedges, stone fences, or especially in the uplands, long swaths of forest. After an hour or so, the forest comes right up along the left side of the train, covering a bank that rises up gently from the railway siding. The train's brakes come on gassily, and the train grumbles to a stop in a whistle-stop station. But the line has forked and ramified quite a bit, more than is warranted by the size of the station. Waterhouse stands, plants his feet squarely, squats down in a sumo wrestler stance, and engages his duffel bag. Duffel appears to be winning as it seemingly pushes Waterhouse out the door of the train and onto the platform. There is a stronger-than-usual smell of coal and a good deal of noise coming from not far away. Waterhouse looks up the line and discovers a heavy industrial works unfurled across the many sidings. He stands and stares for a couple of minutes as his train pulls away, headed for points north, and sees that they are in the business of repairing steam locomotives here at Bletchley Depot. Waterhouse likes trains. But that is not why he got a free suit of clothes and a ticket to Bletchley, and so once again Waterhouse engages Duffel and gets it up the stairs to the enclosed bridge that flies over all of the parallel lines. Looking toward the station, he sees more Bletchley girls, WAFs and Wrens, coming towards him. The day shift, finished with their work, which consists of the processing of ostensibly random letters and digits on a heavy industrial scale. Not wanting to appear ridiculous in their sight, he finally gets Duffel maneuvered onto his back, gets his arms through the shoulder straps, and allows its weight to throw him forward across the bridge. The WAFs and Wrens are only moderately interested in the sight of a newly arriving American officer, or perhaps they are only being demure. In any case, Waterhouse knows he is one of the few, but not the first. Duffel shoves him through the one-room station like a fat cop chivvying a hammerlocked drunk across the lobby of a 2-star hotel. Waterhouse is ejected into a strip of open territory running along the north-south road. Directly across from him, the woods rise up. Any notion that they might be woods of the inviting sort is quickly dissolved by a dense spray of gelid light glinting from the border of the wood as the low sun betrays that the place is saturated with sharpened metal. There is an orifice in the woods, spewing wafts and wrens like the narrow outlet of a giant yellowjacket nest. Waterhouse must either move forward or be pulled onto his back by Duffel and left squirming helplessly in the parking lot like a flipped beetle. So he staggers forward, across the street and onto the wide footpath, into the woods. The Bletchley girls surround him. They have celebrated the end of their shift by applying lipstick. Wartime lipstick is necessarily cobbled together from whatever tailings and gristle were left over once all of the good stuff was used to coat propeller shafts. A florid and cloying scent is needed to conceal its unspeakable mineral and animal origins. It is the smell of war. Waterhouse has not even been given the full tour of BP yet, but he knows the gist of it. He knows that these demure girls, obediently shuffling reams of gibberish through their machines, shift after shift, day after day, have killed more men than Napoleon. He makes slow and apologetic progress against the tide of the departing day shift. At one point, he simply gives up, steps aside, body slams Duffel into the ivy, lights up a cigarette, and waits for a burst of 100 or so girls to go by him. Something pokes at his ankle, a wild raspberry cane, furious with thorns. It supports an uncannily small and tidy spider web, whose geodesic strands gleam in a beam of low afternoon light. The spider in the center is an imperturbable British sort, perfectly unruffled by Waterhouse's clumsy Yank antics. Waterhouse reaches out and catches a yellow-brown elm leaf that happens to fall through the air before him. He hunkers down, plants his cigarette in his mouth, and, using both hands for steadiness, draws the sawtooth rim of the elm leaf across one of the web's radial strands, which he knows will not have any sticky stuff on it. Like a fiddle bow on a string, the leaf sets up a fairly regular vibration in the web. The spider spins to face it, rotating instantly like a character in a badly spliced movie. Waterhouse is so startled by the speed of the move that he starts back just a bit. Then he draws the leaf across the web again. The spider tenses, feeling the vibrations. Eventually, it returns to its original position and carries on as before, ignoring Waterhouse completely. Spiders can tell from the vibrations what sort of insects they have caught and home in on it. There is a reason why the webs are radial, and the spider plants itself at the convergence of the radii. The strands are an extension of its nervous system. Information propagates down the gossamer and into the spider, where it is processed by some kind of internal Turing machine. Waterhouse has tried many different tricks, but he has never been able to spoof a spider. Not a good omen. The rush hour seems to have ended during Waterhouse's science experiment. He engages Duffel once more. The struggle takes them another 100 yards down the path, which finally empties out into a road just at the point where it is barred by an iron gate slung between stupid obelisks of red brick. The guards are, again, RAF men with Sten guns, and right now they are examining the papers of a man in a canvas greatcoat and goggles who has just ridden up on an army green motorcycle with panniers slung over the rear wheel. The panniers are not especially full, but they have been carefully secured. They contain the ammunition that the girls feed into the chattering teeth of their ravenous weapons. The motorcyclist is waved through and makes an immediate left turn down a narrow lane. Attention falls upon Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, who, after a suitable exchange of salutes, presents his credentials. He has to choose among his several sets, which he doesn't manage to hide from the guards, but the guards do not seem alarmed or even curious about this, which sets them distinctly apart from most whom Waterhouse has dealt with. Naturally, these men are not on the ultra-mega list, and so it would be a grave breach of security to tell them that he was here on ultra-mega business. They appear to have greeted many other men who can't state their real business, however, and don't bat an eyelash when Lawrence pretends to be one of the Naval Intelligence Liaisons in Hut 4 or Hut 8. Hut 8 is where they decrypt Naval Enigma transmissions. Hut 4 accepts the decrypts from Hut 8 and analyzes them. If Waterhouse pretends to be a Hut 4 man, the disguise will not last for long because those fellows have to actually know something about the Navy. He perfectly fits the profile of a Hut 8 man, who need not know anything except pure math. One of the RAF men peruses his papers, then steps into a small guardhouse and stirs the crank on a telephone. Waterhouse stands there awkwardly, marveling at the weapons slung from the shoulders of the RAF men. They are, as far as he can tell, nothing more than steel pipes with a trigger mounted toward one end. A small window cut through the pipe provides a view of a coil spring nested inside. A few handles and fittings, bolted on from place to place, do not make the Sten gun look any less like an ill-conceived high school metal shop project.
Captain Waterhouse, you are to proceed to the mansion, says the guard who had spoken on the telephone. You can't miss it.
Waterhouse walks for about 50 feet and finds that the mansion is, indeed, tragically unmissable. He stands and stares at it for a minute, trying to fathom what the architect had been thinking. It is a busy piece of work, with an excessive number of gables. He can only suppose that the designer wanted to build what was really a large single dwelling, but sought to camouflage it as a line of at least half a dozen wildly mismatched urban row houses, inexplicably crammed together in the middle of 600 acres of Buckinghamshire farmland. The place has been well looked after, but as Waterhouse draws closer, he can see black lianas climbing up the brickwork. The root system that he glimpsed in the underground has spread beneath forest and pasture even to this place, and has begun to throw its neoprene creepers upwards. But this organism is not phototropic. It does not grow towards the light, always questing towards the sun. It is infotropic. And it has spread to this place for the same reason that infotropic humans like Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse and Dr. Alan Matheson Turing have come here, because Bletchley Park has roughly the same situation in the info world as the sun does in the solar system. Armies, nations, prime ministers, presidents, and geniuses fall around it, not in steady planet-like orbits, but in the crazy careening ellipses and hyperbole of comets and stray asteroids. Dr. Rudolf von Hackelhaber can't see Bletchley Park because it is the second-best-kept secret in the world, after Ultramega. But from his office in Berlin, sifting through dispatches from the Beobachtungsdienst, he can glimpse fragments of those trajectories and dream up hypotheses to explain why they are just so. If the only logical hypothesis is that the Allies have broken Enigma, then Detachment 2702 will have failed. Lawrence displays further credentials and enters between a pair of weathered griffins. The mansion is nicer once you can no longer see its exterior. Its faux rowhouse design provides many opportunities for bay windows, providing sorely needed light. The hall is held up by Gothic arches and pillars made of a conspicuously low grade of brown marble that looks like vitrified sewage. The place is startlingly noisy. There is a rushing, clattering noise, like rabid applause, permeating walls and doors, carried on a draft of hot air with a stingingly oily scent. It is the peculiar scent of electric teletypes, or teleprinters, as the Brits call them. The noise and the heat suggest there must be dozens of them in one of the mansion's lower rooms. Waterhouse climbs a paneled stairway to what the Brits call the first floor, and finds it quieter and cooler. The high panchendrums of Bletchley have their offices here. If the organization is run true to bureaucratic form, Waterhouse will never see this place again once his initial interview is finished. He finds his way to the office of Colonel Chatton, who, Waterhouse's memory jogged by the sight of the name on the door, is the fellow at the top of the chart of Detachment 2702. Chatton rises to shake his hand. He's strawberry blonde, blue-eyed, and probably would be rosy-cheeked if he didn't have such a deep desert tan at the moment. He is wearing a dress uniform. British officers have their uniforms tailor-made. It is the only way to obtain them. Waterhouse is hardly a clothes horse, but he can see at a glance that Chatton's uniform was not thrown together by Mummy in a few evenings in front of a flickering coal grate. No, Chatton has himself an honest-to-God tailor somewhere. Yet when he speaks Waterhouse's name, he does not say Wotahice like the Broadway Buildings crowd. The R comes through hard and crackling, and the house part is elongated into something like hoose. He has some kind of a wild-ass accent on him, this Chatton. With Chatton is a smaller man in British fatigues, tight at the wrists and ankles, otherwise blousy, a thick khaki flannel that would be intolerably hot if these people couldn't rely on a steady ambient temperature, indoors and out, of about 55 degrees. The overall effect always reminds Waterhouse of Dr. Denton's. This fellow is introduced as Lieutenant Robson, and he is the leader of one of 2702's two squads, the RAF one. He has a bristly mustache, trimmed very short, of silver and auburn whiskers. He is a cheerful sort, at least in the presence of higher ranks, and smiles frequently. His teeth splay out radially from the gum line so that each mandible has the appearance of a coffee can in which a small grenade has been detonated.
"This the fellow we've been waiting for," Chatton says to Robson. "The one we could have used in Algiers."
"Yes," Robson says. "Welcome to Detachment 2701, Captain Waterhouse."
2702, Waterhouse says. Chatton and Robson look ever so mildly startled.
"We can't use 2701 because it is the product of two primes."
"I beg your pardon," Robson says.
One thing Waterhouse likes about these Brits is that when they don't know what the hell you are talking about, they are at least open to the possibility that it might be their fault. Robson has the look of a man who has come up through the ranks. A Yank of that type would already be scornful and blustery.
"Which ones?" Chatton says.
That is encouraging. He at least knows what a prime number is. 73 and 37, Waterhouse says. This makes a profound impression on Chatton.
"Ah, yes, I see."
He shakes his head.
"I shall have to give the proof a good chuffing about this."
Robson has cocked his head far to one side, so that it is almost resting upon the thick woolly beret chucked into his epaulet. He is squinting and has an aghast look about him. His hypothetical Yank counterpart would probably demand, at this point, a complete explanation of prime number theory, and when it was finished, denounce it as horseshit. But Robson just lets it go by.
"Am I to understand that we are changing the number of our detachment?"
Waterhouse swallows. It seems clear from Robson's reaction that this is going to involve a great deal of busy work for Robson and his men. Weeks of painting and stenciling and of trying to propagate the new number throughout the military bureaucracy. It will be a miserable pain in the ass.
2702 it is, Chatton says breezily.
Unlike Waterhouse, he has no difficulty issuing difficult, unpopular commands.
"Right then, I must see to some things. Pleasure making your acquaintance, Captain Waterhouse."
"Pleasure's mine."
Robson shakes Waterhouse's hand again and excuses himself.
"We have a billet for you in one of the huts to the south of the canteen," Chatton says. "Bletchley Park is our nominal headquarters, but we anticipate that we'll spend most of our time in those theaters where heaviest use is being made of ultra."
"I take it you've been in North Africa," Waterhouse says.
"Yes."
Chatton raises his eyebrows, or rather the ridges of skin where his eyebrows are presumably located. The hairs are colorless and transparent, like nylon monofilament line.
"Just got out by the skin of our teeth there, I'm afraid."
"Had a close shave, did you?"
"Oh, I don't mean it that way," Chatton says.
"I'm talking about the integrity of the ultra-secret. We're still not sure whether we have survived it, but the proof has done some calculations, suggesting that we may be out of the woods."
"The prof is what you call Dr. Turing?"
"Yes. He recommended you personally, you know."
"When the orders came through, I speculated as much."
"Turing is presently engaged on at least two other fronts of the information war and could not be part of a happy few."
"What happened in North Africa, Colonel Chatton?"
"It's still happening," Chatton says bemusedly.
Our Marine squad is still in theater, widening the bell curve.
Widening the bell curve?
Well, you know better than I do that random things typically have a bell-shaped distribution. Heights, for example. Come over to this window, Captain Waterhouse.
Waterhouse joins Chatton at a bay window, where there is a view across acres of what used to be gently undulating farmland. Looking beyond the wooded belt to the uplands miles away, he can see what Bletchley Park probably used to look like. Green fields dotted with clusters of small buildings. But that is not what it looks like now. There is hardly a piece of land within half a mile that has not been recently paved or built upon. Once you get beyond the mansion and its quaint little outbuildings, the park consists of one-story brick structures, nothing more than long corridors with multiple transepts, rows of plus signs, and new ones being added as fast as the masons can slap bricks on mud. Waterhouse wonders idly whether Rudy has seen aerial reconnaissance photos of this place and deduced from all of those plus signs the mathematical nature of the enterprise. The tortuous channels between buildings are narrow, and each is made twice as narrow by an 8-foot-high blast wall running down the middle of it, so that the Jerrys will have to spend at least one bomb for each building.
"And that building there,"
Chatton says, pointing to a small building not far away, a truly wretched-looking brick hovel,
"are the Turing booms. That's boom with an E on the end. They are calculating machines invented by your friend, the Prof."
"Are they true universal Turing machines?" Waterhouse blurts. He is in the grip of a stunning vision of what Bletchley Park might in fact be. A secret kingdom in which Alan has somehow found the resources needed to realize his great vision. A kingdom ruled not by men, but by information, where humble buildings made of plus signs house universal machines that can be configured to perform any computable operation.
"No,"
Chatton says, with a gentle, sad smile. Waterhouse exhales for a long time.
"Ah.
Perhaps that will come next year, or the next."
"Perhaps."
"The booms were adapted by Turing and Welchman and others, from a design dreamed up by Polish cryptanalysts. They consist of rotating drums that test many possible Enigma keys with great speed. I'm sure the Prof will explain it to you, but the point is that they have these vast pegboards in the back, like telephone switchboards. And some of our girls have the job of putting the right pegs into the right holes and wiring the things up every day. Requires good eyesight, careful attention, and height."
"Height."
"You'll notice that the girls who are assigned to that particular duty are unusually tall. If the Germans were to somehow get their hands on the personnel records for all of the people who work at Bletchley Park and graph their heights on a histogram, they would see a normal bell-shaped curve, representing most of the workers, with an abnormal bump on it, representing the unusual population of tall girls whom we have brought in to work the plug boards."
"Yes, I see,"
Waterhouse says. "And someone like Rudy, Dr. von Hackelhaber, would notice the anomaly and wonder about it."
"Precisely," Chatton says. "And it would then be the job of Detachment 2702, the Ultra-Mega Group, to plant false information that would throw your friend Rudy off the scent."
Chatton turns away from the window, strolls over to his desk, and opens a large cigarette box, neatly stacked with fresh ammunition. He offers one to Waterhouse with a deft hand gesture, and Waterhouse accepts it, just to be social. As Chatton is giving him a light, he gazes through the flame into Waterhouse's eye and says,
"I put it to you now. How would you go about concealing from your friend Rudy that we had a lot of tall girls here?"
"Assuming that he already had the personnel records?"
"Yes."
"Then it would be too late to conceal anything."
"Granted. Let us instead assume that he has some channel of information that is bringing him these records, a few at a time. This channel is still open and functioning. We cannot shut it down. Or perhaps we choose not to shut it down, because even the absence of this channel will tell Rudy something important."
"Well, there you go, then," Waterhouse says. "We gin up some false personnel records and plant them in the channel." There is a small chalkboard on the wall of Chatton's office. It is a palimpsest, not very well erased. The housekeeping detail here must have a standing order never to clean it, lest something important be lost. As Waterhouse approaches it, he can see older calculations layered atop each other, fading off into the blackness like transmissions of white light propagating into deep space. He recognizes Alan's handwriting all over the place. It takes a physical effort not to stand there and try to reconstruct Alan's calculations from ghosts lingering on the slate. He draws over them only with reluctance. Waterhouse slashes an abscissa and an ordinate onto the board, then sweeps out a bell-shaped curve. On top of the curve, to the right of the peak, he adds a little bump. "The tall girls," he explains. "The problem is this notch." He points to the valley between the main peak and the bump. Then he draws a new peak high and wide enough to cover both. "We can do that by planting fake personnel records in Rudy's channel, giving heights that are taller than the overall average, but shorter than the bomb girls." "But now you've dug yourself another hole," Chatton says. He is leaning back in his officer's swivel chair, holding the cigarette in front of his face, regarding Waterhouse through a motionless cloud of smoke. Waterhouse says, "Well, the new curve looks a little better because I filled in that gap, but it's not really bell-shaped. It doesn't tail off right out here at the edges. Dr. von Heckelhaber will notice that. He'll realize that someone's been tampering with his channel. To prevent that from happening, I would have to plant more fake records, giving some unusually large and small values."
"Invent some fake girls who are exceptionally short or tall," Chatton says.
"Yes, that would make the curve tail off in the way that it should." Chatton continues to look at him expectantly. Waterhouse says,
"So the addition of a small number of what would otherwise be bizarre anomalies make it all look perfectly normal."
"As I said," Chatton says,
"our squad is in North Africa, even as we speak, widening the bell curve, making it all look perfectly normal."